This evening we're going to look at verses 47 through 56. We're going to talk about the arrest of Jesus. And really this is the very point in time. I appreciate Landon reading the verses prior to that, kind of setting the scene. Jesus is here in the Garden of Gethsemane. And these are the final moments that he really has to himself and with his disciples before everything basically just falls apart, leading to his ultimate crucifixion. These are very heartbreaking moments in my mind, just reading them and thinking about everything surrounding them, from just the atmosphere that they're in to the subtle looks that might have been going on between one person and another. All of these things, the tone of voice that Jesus must have used and the disciples must have used, all these things that perhaps are not captured here in these words, but it comes to my mind and kind of creates the vividness what these verses truly mean, what they truly hold, and hopefully we can bring out some of those things tonight as we're studying. I was told Logan had the last question last week, so Bart will have question number one, which is this: why did Jesus need to kiss, or why did Judas need to kiss Jesus to mark him? Wouldn't the soldiers have known who Jesus was? In verses 47 through 49.
Well, Judas didn't have to have a prearranged signal that was a kiss necessarily for the soldiers to know who Jesus was, but it certainly has some elements of convenience. As he betrays the Lord, it was a prearranged signal for the soldiers so that they could spring into action. John 18 verse 3 tells us it was a cohort of Roman soldiers. And a cohort's 500 to 600 soldiers that had been detached from the garrison in the Tower of Antonio. And a lot of the commentators think that these were new soldiers in the area. It's Passover, and the city swelled to 1 million-plus people. And so Rome would bring in additional soldiers. And so these weren't soldiers that had been around who had seen the prophet that everyone had been talking about. These were soldiers that didn't know who Jesus was. This is just another task for them. They've been told, we're going to capture this guy on the Mount of Olives in the Garden of Gethsemane. So they needed someone to identify the soldier. Also, it's dark. It's nighttime. There's hundreds of people present. And if the intended target runs, then you want to have someone identify them before they run so that you can snag that person as they run into the woods. They didn't have a photograph or an FBI poster to identify them. So it's very convenient from that sense. It's also convenient from the sense that Jesus wasn't a physically remarkable person. You know, if Jesus had been 6'5" or blonde or extraordinarily handsome, you could have told the soldiers, just look for the handsome guy and grab him. But we know from Isaiah 53:2 that there was no beauty that we should desire Jesus. He was an ordinary guy, ordinary looking person. And so they couldn't use that. So they decided upon a kiss. And why a kiss? Well, it's the ultimate form of betrayal to kiss, kissing a king. You know, we know from Psalm 2 where it says kiss the son, that the proper attitude that a servant would have towards their king would be to kiss their king or their friend. And so this was showing your service, your fealty, your loyalty. A kiss means so much in this world. And so by betraying Jesus with a kiss, Judas is telling us how he really feels about Jesus. He is rejecting Jesus, and he is saying that I do not value you as the Messiah.
Very good. Very good. Any other comments here on this event, on Judas' kiss, why he would need to do that?
Yeah, Cody. Yeah, I had many of the same thoughts as Brother Bart, especially in Isaiah, you know, him not having an appearance that any should desire him. But I think something that's really interesting is the nature in which he says he is the one sees him. This is someone that's walked with Christ. He's witnessed, you know, the acts of Christ. He knows the power that he has. So in administering a kiss, it's not like he's running up and pointing his finger and saying, seize him. It's more of a subtle thing. And like he says, it's denoting the closeness that was common for that period of time. between a master and a pupil, or between, you know, general friends.
Right. Exactly. Lauren.
Jesus had escaped him before. Like in John 10:39, you know, he kind of escapes through the crowd, so I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because if anyone knew how elusive Jesus could be, if he wanted to, it would be Judas, because at that moment in time, did he do that twice? It seems to me there was the time where they were going to stone him in John, and then there was also the time where they wanted to crown him king, also in John. And it seems, if I remember right, I think he slipped through the cracks in those immensely large crowds both times. So this Jesus slipping off, and of course I think we understand why Jesus would do that in both of those times. That wasn't his time to fulfill the things that was prophesied of him. This was the time. So we know Jesus knew going in that there wasn't an escape plan. But Judas didn't know that. Of course, he's operating off an entirely different basis. Yeah, Bill.
I thought it was interesting that this word kiss, as Bart mentioned, it was like the ultimate show of respect, this hugging and kissing in that day and time. That's the same word. This hugging and kissing is the same word that was used to describe the prodigal son's father when he was welcoming him back, that same kind of kiss. And I couldn't help but wonder if maybe Judas was put on a show, you know, and somewhere I read it was this loud announcing, greetings, Rabbi, and making a big deal like it was his best buddy. And you know, wouldn't that hurt Jesus the most to be betrayed by somebody that wasn't with part of the original 12? So I think that's part of it too. Let's make this hurt as bad as we can.
Well, as the saying goes, adding insult to injury. This is the ultimate insult, really. From what Judas was to Jesus to what he had turned into, this is the as close to a slap in the face as one could get, was ironically the kiss. Any other comments before we move on to question number two? Okay. So question number two, this will be for Landon. Why did Jesus ask Judas why he had come, referring to him as a friend? There in verse 50.
Well, I kind of answered this 3 weeks ago. I jumped to this verse out of turn when we weren't studying it, but I'll just go over what I said back then. The word friend here in the Greek is the word hetairos, which means false friend. It's used four times in the New Testament. The first time is in Matthew 11, when it's the complaining children in the marketplace. The verse says, it's Matthew 11, verse 16, "But to what shall I liken this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to their companions," which is the same word as friend here. It's in Matthew 22, when the king calls out to the man who doesn't have his wedding garment. He says, "Friend, why do you not have your wedding garment?" It's in Matthew chapter 20. It's when the owner comes out to the people who are murmuring behind his vineyard. And then the last time is in this chapter. And there's two different types of friends. There's the friend that's used here in this verse, hetairos, and then there's the friend philos, which actually means the friend. There's love, there's affection in that word. Something interesting that I read from commentator, forget who it was this phrase, after friend, why have you come, is translated three different ways. It's translated as a command, as a statement, and here is a question. And the commentator prefers the command, which is what the NIV uses, and it says, "Do what you came here for."
Very good, very good. I think some of the older translations, we're talking about the NIV, some of the older translations do this verse, this statement, quite the disservice, not really portraying exactly what Jesus is actually saying. So very good picking up on that. Any other comments here on question number two?
Cool. Yeah, in Lange's commentary, he took a little bit different perspective on that. He said this quote, "It's to give us an example of the utmost meekness and gentleness under the greatest provocation." And then also, "If the face of the Savior was not disgraced by the traitor's kiss, no amount of injury and insult heaped upon his followers by the enemies can really dishonor the former, but falls back with double force upon the latter." Meaning that, you know, in this scenario, if Jesus can take this level of persecution and betrayal at the hands of someone who is actually close and followed along with him, anything that they were to encounter in the upcoming could be encountered with the same kind of grace. And I think you see that with Stephen. He's even praying for the mercy of the people stoning him in his persecution. So.
Thank you.
Yeah, Bill. He was shortly acknowledging Judas as friend. Shortly, immediately, they were seizing Jesus, and I was kind of wondering when I was thinking about this event, is if Jesus acknowledged he knew Judas, and Judas is making this big to do about Jesus, then that would give an opportunity. It doesn't in this text. I don't think it said that. Then let the others go, you know. But that might have been a little bit of it as well. You know, hey, yes, friend, and then everyone would know, okay, this is the guy.
Mm-hmm. I think it's in John's account that Jesus explicitly says to let the others go, but that Judas' action may have also alerted the soldiers to that as well. Lauren?
Kind of what Landon was talking about, the statement. The ASB says, "Do that for which thou art come, not why." Barnes speculated that this was what caused Judas to think about this one last time as he did it.
Mm-hmm. I think it, on any normal person, it should have elicited that response, right? To cause someone to rethink what you're actually doing here. Really consider this moment and what you're doing. Reading it again, you know, sometimes I think we all say this, you know, you've read these verses so many times, time after time, and each time you do, sometimes you pick up something new. And for me, this time I picked up Judas. And what Judas is doing is just so despicable. In that one moment, Luke's account in chapter 22, verse 48, says, "Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss." So again, I think it's perhaps a little bit of mercy, but also a whole lot of judgment too, saying that I think Jesus is telling him, in a sense, this is not okay, and I know exactly what you're doing. And you're not fooling me. You may have everyone else fooled, but I've already figured it out. That's kind of what I came away with. Any other comment here? Question number two. Yeah, Larry.
Warren brought out the point that he has a chance to repent even up to this moment of time. I think Jesus is teaching us a lesson here. He's walking the extra mile with this man. He's giving another chance. And I think we're to walk the extra mile with people. Mm-hmm. I think that's the example Jesus is setting here. I'm not trying to take away. I'm not a book smart person, but I'm just trying to point out the best I can.
Well, you don't have to be. That's the good news. But I think you're absolutely right. It's again, this was one of the dirtiest things that a person could ever do to another human being. And Jesus, I think you're right. I think there's an element there where he gives him another chance to think about. And you know, we might think about all the things that Judas could have done at that moment, realizing that he had made a mistake. You know, maybe he could have jumped in and said, you know, "I've made a mistake. you know, we're going to call this whole thing off. Doubt he probably could have at that point, but at least he would have been on the road to repentance. But Jesus gave him that opportunity and he didn't take it. Any other comments here before I move on? Okay, question number three. Oh, yeah. Question number three for Levi. Who cut off the servant's ear? What was the servant's name? And why did this disciple have a sword in the first place? It's kind of a bigger three-part question there.
Okay, so to answer the first two questions, we can just go to another gospel, and that's John 18, and then in verses 10 through 11. So it says, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus." So the man with the sword is Peter, and that's kind of an extension of his character that we saw from previous chapters, where he just has this misdirected zeal for Jesus that he just uses in all the wrong places. So for the third question, why did this disciple have a sword in the first place? To answer this without really just having any disagreements, because I don't really have a really good answer myself. The disciples had swords because they lacked faith in Jesus' power, and they completely rejected all this prophecy of him going to the cross and dying, and Peter wasn't too interested in, I guess maybe he blocked out a lot of what Jesus had said previously, but we can just see that his fervor for the Lord was there, but it was just in all the wrong places. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Peter, I think he always had good intentions for everything that he did, but so many times it was misplaced, and I think you're right. And I wonder sometimes if it was by providential design that they had, I don't know, selective amnesia or whatever you want to call it, that they, Jesus had told them so many times that these things were going to happen, and they still, he still acts out in this way. Yeah,
and I'd also like to point out how hard it would have been to make this decision with all of the Roman soldiers standing around. I mean, obviously it was the totally wrong thing to do, but, I mean, that really does show a lot of, I mean, I don't want to act like this is a good thing that he did, but it shows a lot of his character and his zeal, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine how many of these Roman soldiers all just staring at you as you do this. Huh?
Right. I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more. In fact, Kaufman said, from the human view, one must admire Peter. His was the only blow struck in defense of the Lord, although struck contrary to Jesus' will and without his approval. So there's a certain element there where you kind of have to be impressed. Yeah.
So you mentioned Kaufman, and I think it was Kaufman that suggested this, and I thought, wow, that's kind of insightful. The idea that Peter's boasting about being willing to die, I mean, maybe he was thinking, I'll fight, and I'll die for you fighting. Mm-hmm. And Peter seems to demonstrate that, but that's not the kind of denying that Christ is telling Peter you're going to do. So
right.
I think maybe Peter was, I'll die for you.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not, you know.
I'll prove him wrong.
Yeah.
Hey, here I am proving you wrong, Lord. I'll take on however many hundred soldiers are here, and, you know, I'll probably die, but I'll die fighting. Just like I said, I would. Yeah, I think you're right. Any other comments here? This question. Might add, as far as where the swords came from, or why they might have had them at this particular time, we might look at Luke 22:35-38. And it says, "And he said to them, when I sent you without money bag, knapsack, and sandals, did you lack anything? They said, nothing. And he said to them, but now he who has a money bag, let him take it, and likewise a knapsack. He who has no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. For I say to you that this which is written must still be accomplished in me. And he was numbered with the transgressors, for the things concerning me have an end. So they said, look, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough." So that's why they had swords there in the Garden of Gethsemane, although it seems to indicate that they only had two. So again, Peter, it mentions him having a sword. as the reason why he did this. So it seems to me that there were a limited number of swords for him to be called out there as one who had a sword. So I tend to think that there was only two. There was a couple commentators that said, well, that doesn't mean that they went that they didn't go out and sell his garment and buy one. But I think the wording here indicates that there was a very limited number there. Any other comments here before we get into question number four? Yeah.
One more thing Kaufman also pointed out. Malchus was the high priest's servant. And I like the idea, and I want to give Peter a little bit of credit, it appears. He might have been going after the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, wow, I never thought of that before. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. That's a good point. And again, when you really stop and consider all of the little details and the thought processes behind the actions of each individual, I think Peter there, like I said, he might be making a big a political statement, if you want to call it such. But going after him. Another thing to mention too, a lot of people point to John's mention. John's the only gospel that mentions that it's Peter that had the sword and that struck the servant's ear, and that the servant's name was Malchus. A lot of people use this verse to say that this means that John's gospel was written later and probably after Simon Peter's death, because the other gospels didn't mention it to kind of conceal his identity, so that the authorities wouldn't come after him for something that was clearly against the law, clearly something that one should not do. But it was John who, they say, wrote his gospel later on that included this for whatever reason. So just a little tidbit there. Of course, that's open for debate. Anything else before we move on to question number four? Okay. What was the lesson that Jesus wanted the disciples to learn by bringing swords into the Garden of Gethsemane?
I think the main point would be that the battle that they are going to go on, the fight, is a spiritual battle. It's a battle in the spiritual realm, not against flesh and blood. So this is not going to be the way that Christians accomplish their mission. They're not to take up arms in order to carry on the message of Christ as has been characterized in so many other religions and sects, and kind of as you see is, you know, Catholic Christianity kind of throughout the ages with the Crusades and things like that. So it's just ultimately making this point, hey, here you had a direct example where the sword was used right in front of me. I'm going to rebuke that and set the standard straight of what is to go forward.
Very good. Any other comments here? Question number four. Lord.
In John 18:11, it says, shall I not drink the cup? Last week we talked about Jesus willing to do the Father's will. So he's telling Peter here that he needs to do the Father's will and not to try to halt that.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments here? Mark.
Yeah, along those lines, when in Matthew 16, which is obviously just a few chapters before this, Jesus began to show his disciples he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and raised the third day. That's verse 21. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you. And then Jesus said to Peter famously, get behind me, Satan. You know, Peter had, but those words must have hurt Peter. Get behind me, Satan. But Peter hadn't reflected on that, I don't think. Because if he had, he would realize the Lord said, I'm going to be killed and raised.
Yeah.
Trying to prevent that is the work of Satan.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
I think another lesson is found in verse 53, when Jesus reminded them, don't you think I could pray to my Father and he'd send help? Yeah. You know, 12 legions? And I think Jesus was telling his disciples, I could get out of this if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. There's three lessons that I was thinking about, and we've all kind of touched on. Number one, that violence is not the answer. I was going to say violence is never the answer, but occasionally if someone asks you, what does it mean to kill somebody, you say, well, you might say that's violence. Violence would be the answer to that. So violence can be the answer sometimes, but violence for Jesus Christ is not the answer. It never will be. It never has been. Number two, Jesus did not need protection. And this was his statement there, that he could call 12 legions of angels if he wanted to. Peter was all gung-ho about protecting Jesus. And there was a couple of people that said if there was ever a time to take up arms to defend the church or the Lord or anything spiritual, this was the time. So Peter takes this opportunity without really waiting for Jesus' answer. I think there's an account where it talks about how the disciples asked, should we go ahead? Should we try to do this? Peter just goes on ahead and does his business there. But Jesus stops him saying that I really don't need this protection. I've got everything under control. And that leads to the third lesson, is that this is God's plan. This is everything is going exactly the way that it's supposed to be. Clark said, neither Christ nor his religion is to be defended by the secular arm. God is sufficiently able to support his art. Uzzah need not stretch out his hand on the occasion. Even the shadow of public justice is not to be resisted by a private person when coming from those in public authority. The cause of a Christian is the cause of God. Sufferings belong to one and vengeance to the other. Let the cause therefore rest in his hands, who will do it ample justice. So I thought that was interesting. Any other? Yeah, Levi.
And not to talk too much about Peter, because this is sort of unrelated. I know we're talking about it a lot, but this, I feel like, for me, it seems like this is giving him another reason to deny Jesus in front of other people, because this, if you don't know God's plan, this is laughable. I mean, it kind of seems like if you're a Roman soldier or you're people there who don't know God's plan, it kind of seems like someone who's just boasting, but if you ask him to do the thing he's boasting about, he just says he doesn't want to do it right now. You know, it's laughable. And I feel like that's part of the reason why later in Matthew, when the servant girls and all the people are asking Peter, were you with Jesus? He says no. Just a thought.
That is a good thought. I hadn't considered that. But certainly Peter would have been very confused at this moment. And probably there where he's presented, he's ready to fight. Again, thinking totally different than what Jesus is thinking about God's plan. And he's ready to fight. He's ready to bring in this new era of the Messiah and nationalism and so on and so forth. But, it could very well be a reason. Mark.
Yeah, and I think we made this point last week, but what Jesus said in the Garden of Gethsemane, don't sleep, but pray, lest you fall into temptation. This is the temptation. The temptation is to take up a sword and strike with violence. It's sin. Peter's committing sin. And so Jesus wanted them to reflect on what he had said, how he was going to die, and and how it was transgression to have swords. It was sinful to have swords on their person. And so he wanted them to reflect on that and pray about it and then reach the right decision, and then they would not have been in the place they were in later. And so that, because they slept and they didn't pray, then all of the disciples, as you pointed out in Luke, it says they all were ready to fight. It wasn't just Peter. We need to remember that. They all asked the Lord, shall we strike? So none of them understood the plan.
Right. Yeah. Very good. Anything else for you? No, we probably better go ahead and move on. Bill, question number 5 for you. How many angels constitutes 12 legions? What would the consequences have been if Jesus had called the angels for his protection at any time during his trial or crucifixion? And what lessons could be derived from Jesus' resolve to fulfill the Father's will despite having an exit available?
Well, for question 5A, I got a little bit of mixed results in consulting some of the different folks. Kaufman said that a legion was 3,000 men. That would be 36,000 holy angels. Chris Wells said that it would have been 6,000 per legion, and that would have been 72,000 holy angels. And then another source said, yeah, 72,000 holy angels on foot and another 84 horse soldiers. So a lot. Mm-hmm. And when you think about what the power of one angel and the episode with the 185,000 mm-hmm. that one angel killed, he had plenty of firepower behind him. 5B, what would the consequences have been if Jesus called the angels for his protection? Well, scripture would not have been fulfilled. A way for redemption of mankind would not have happened according to God's plan there. And we don't know what the future would have held. And so then what lessons could be derived? Well, it should make us even more appreciative of Christ's sacrifice. It should make us ashamed at how little we are willing to sacrifice to God, and to consider that all he was willing to endure for us. And thirdly, what a terrible death awaited Christ. What a terrible death awaited Christ was committed to being obedient to his Father. So in light of all that he knew what lay ahead of him, and yet he still had to resolve to be the obedient son to his Father.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Any other comments here? Question number 5. Like Bill, I got kind of mixed results with the legions there. I think, too, it seems to me as though in response to Peter's action, with Peter, there's 10 other disciples besides that, 12, including Jesus. And it's almost to me like he's saying, there's 12 of us here. Do you not think I can call 12 legions of angels and take care of this whole thing? Us by ourselves, 12 human beings cannot go up against this. Again, pointing to the lack of thought in Peter's actions, him taking on a whole army of several hundred people by himself, Jesus says, again, I have this covered. And to me, this is one of the hardest things, and the thing that I think probably would have tempted me most if I had went through these type of things is that knowing I could have an out. I had an exit available if I wanted it, if I ever needed it. To me, every person has, I think, some type of breaking point, maybe. It doesn't seem that Jesus really did, but when you hit that breaking point, knowing that you could, at the faintest whisper in everything, that to me would have, and probably was, the greatest temptation that I certainly would have faced, and maybe one of the greatest that Jesus did as well. But the consequences of doing that, to me, the biggest one was that it would have made God a liar. If God's a liar, because of prophecy, because of everything that he said would happen, and ensured would happen, and planned would happen, if God's a liar, then everything is, it's all for naught. To me, that was what was at stake. But God had enough trust that he put all of his eggs in a basket, if you will. He put everything on the shoulders of the man, the human, Jesus Christ. And Jesus pulled through. And to me, that's it's a lesson really beyond my comprehension. What was at stake? What Jesus had to go through, what was going through his mind, or what he passed through with flying colors. Anything else on this question? Okay, question number 6. Final question here for Hunter. When did this conversation take place with the multitudes that arrested Jesus? What scriptures were fulfilled, and why did the disciples flee?
Going back to that last question real quick. I appreciate your comments at the end there, because it's always been a really interesting notion to me that Jesus was really contemplating this as far as calling the angels, and that he makes it seem that it's a viable possibility. So having that there, and then with God like
then it messes up everything. Mm-hmm. And so that's always been an interesting little thing to me. But as far as this question goes, reading the verses, I kind of had always assumed these followed sequentially. I suppose this could have been a little bit later. Maybe they were walking along, or maybe even once they got into the city that they had this conversation, or that Jesus says these words to them. I would like to think it was right then, because they're coming out to him and not even bound yet or anything like that. So probably in the garden, but it could have been elsewhere. As far as what scriptures were fulfilled, it's really just kind of a generalization. All the prophecies and scriptures talk about his betrayal and his death and everything in that regard. And why the disciples flee, this is something that I think we've touched on multiple times so far. Multiple people have touched on, I think probably the biggest reason, and you can say lack of faith, but probably it is there. Here's this massive crowd, and you know these are men, and they're intimidated, and they see what's happening to Jesus, and they fear the same outcome for themselves, and so you know that human instinct, that fight or flight, sort of they just go, mm-hmm. And so I think that was what caused them to flee. So.
Very good, very good. Any other comments here? On this last question. See if I can find it real quick. There's a comment I found that was really, really good as to why the disciples flee. That's not it. Ah, here it is. My apologies. This is Criswell, actually. It says, in judging the disciples, we should remember that Jesus requests their release. We must also remember that to their stunned amazement, he has forbidden the resistance they have offered. They should give no fight, and if remaining imperils their own lives, no doubt they feel it highly logical to flee. This reasoning does not necessarily excuse their cowardice, but perhaps suggests their motivation. Earlier, Jesus had predicted the sheep would be scattered, and now it has come to pass. Fowler suggests that the disciples' flight is as much providential as it is from fear. Had the disciples been caught and tried with Jesus, they might not have stopped, like Peter, with a simple denial of him. Fowler says they might have been shocked so irreparably that nothing could have saved them like a remorseful Judas. They might not have lived to see the resurrection nor be transformed by its victory. I thought that was really insightful as to the disciples here, and how providentially it was better almost for them to flee than to have to go through similar things that Jesus went through, but with little faith and zero understanding of the circumstances surrounding that. They were spared from that and allowed to see the glory of the resurrection, the power of that, and then their faith was restored. So I thought that was interesting. Any concluding comments? Len?
Just as a side point, this isn't relevant to the question, but there's an interesting connection that a commentator I read made, and it's about the phrase there in those verses, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me?" And he pointed to Matthew chapter 21, in verse 13, where it reads, and this is Jesus going into the temple and kicking out all of the Jews there. And it says, "And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." And so the commentator pointed out, this is a group of people who have been sent to capture Jesus, and the people who sent them are actual robbers. And they come to violently capture someone who's not actually a robber. So it's just an interesting point.
That is a good point. I like that. All right, it's a little past time, but it was well worth it for these verses, so we'll conclude there. Appreciate everyone's good study, good comments, as always.